Welcome to the Tribe of Two, the officially unofficial podcast for The Mandalorian on Disney+. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 7, titled Chapter 15, The Believer. Aaron, what did you think of this episode?
I really like this episode. I think there's a couple of... I can't tell whether they're just mistakes or they're actually things that they're going to build on future plots going forward. And there's a couple things I thought were shaky when we were transitioning from action scene to action scene, like... How far is stormtrooper armor going to fall? Like, this stuff is, you know, if it was made of styrofoam, it would actually be more effective because I don't think in any universe Cara Dune can go and just double hammer guys into, like, I even not wearing a helmet, I'm not sure slamming my head into a steering wheel once is going to take me out. If I'm wearing a helmet, goddamn, if anything, that should protect me from that kind of head trauma. But
yeah, otherwise,
this show
what's
hates
the point?
Stormtroopers. This show hates stormtroopers and stormtrooper armor, and other than that, I thought it was pretty cool.
It does, yeah. Like the mythos around stormtroopers at this point is so weird, and like I thought it was like weird. Okay, well they can't even take a blaster shot, in the original series and stuff. What's the point of the armor? And then Boba Fett comes in and blasts a few of them with a Durfee stick. And then you're like, okay, well, it can't take a shot from a weapon, but it's got a spike. And maybe there's some ceramic shit that I don't know what's going on here. But then it can't even take a punch. It can't even take a punch. What's the point of wearing armor that can't take a punch?
And apparently you can't. This is something that, like, I always thought that, like, Luke Skywalker not being able to see out of stormtrooper armor is more of, like, it doesn't fit him. Because if you can't see out of a helmet, then what the shit? Yeah, like, this is some nutso stuff, man. But Fellini and Favre think it's funny that stormtroopers are essentially buffoons clad in toilet paper. You're going to have to roll with that when it comes to the Mando. But
just take it off. Just take it off. It's not providing any protection. Take it off. If it's impairing your vision, get rid of it.
Yeah, go into combat naked. That really strike fear in the hearts of the Empire's enemies.
At just least
full-on naked stormtroopers.
Then you could lift your kilt at them. But you can't do anything here.
Yeah, but there's also a lot of subtle jokes. Like, I really like Fett's ops, like, when everyone's talking about who could go in incognito and everyone's got their problems, and Fett's like, let's just say they might recognize my face. I thought that was, like, that's peak Star Wars humor right there. Like, yeah, there's enough old Clone Wars veterans kicking around, and everybody kind of remembers, like, that, yeah, you can't, he can't.
Yeah.
He's perhaps the most famous stormtrooper face in the galaxy. So,
for sure.
I like that stuff a lot.
And I even like the joke of him, like, I'm taking this helmet off. I can't see anything out of it. Because we see, like, a POV of Mando in the helmet last episode when he's looking around this rock that he's trying to put Baby Yoda on to meditate. And he can't see anything. His field of view is trash. He's got, like, a 4-degree field of view here out of this helmet. It's not good. So, and of course, the callback to, you know, the Luke Skywalker stuff. But I didn't hate this episode. I think it's doing some interesting things with the messy part of being a Mandalorian and being a rebel and being an Imperial, right? Like, they have kind of all sides of that. And I thought the Mayfeld turn in this episode was actually pretty good for as thin as it is, like, as much as you can do in a 38-minute episode, including credits and recap.
Yeah.
They did a pretty good job conveying, like, okay, not everything, even on the Imperial side, is, like, gung-ho. There are some, controversies.
Yeah. I just thought the most unrealistic is when Bill Barr took down the whole base with just 15 minutes of stand-up comedy. Took on the whole... You piece of shit, one bridge having refinery. You got just completely took on the whole fucking planet. And for 15 minutes, they didn't know what to do. If you don't know what I'm referring to, Bill Barr legendarily took on the entire city of Philadelphia in a comedy special gone bad.
The Attorney General of the United States took on the entire city of Philadelphia.
Bill Barr, exactly.
Okay. So there are parts of this that I enjoyed. The action scene.
He's taking on bigger cities and, like, come on, Bill Barr. He's taking on a lot bigger cities than just Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah. I will say the action scenes in this are a little, like, meh. I don't know. It doesn't compare to, like, Boba Fett flying up in jetpacks, right? And
It's almost like I thought they played as comedy, kind of like some of the way that like the Indiana Jones fights are, like the Mandalorian like visibly like sighing like, God, I got to do this again, or, you know, not having, you know, seen him fight without his all of his gadgets and armor and still being a badass was cool. But it was more of kind of like a joke of, you know, never ending waves of enemies. It felt like a video game. You know, like you have to get to the thing and the waves are going to come faster and more until you get to the checkpoint. And then the game auto wins with the strafing stormtroopers and TIE fighters. But they weren't designed, I think, to be the most exciting things in the world.
Well, that's the thing. The action scenes on the train or on the transport that they're driving, these juggernauts, is actually cooler than the stuff they do at the base. And I was thinking, like, the base, they have to shoot their way out. And I'm like, It just happens so fast. It's like they shoot a few guys, they walk out the window, Boba Fett picks them up and done. I'm like,
see, I thought they were going to shoot their way out. One. I thought that was the exciting, the combined fire, the ladies doing Overwatch with sniper rifles, climbing out the window, doing the Harrison Ford fugitive dance on the dam.
I know. immediately thought that too.
Boba Fett doing the, you know, dropping the sonic whammers. I thought that stuff was cool. Yeah. I thought the stuff on the train was a little pedestrian because it was just essentially hand-to-hand combat, green screen hand-to-hand combat.
I was just disappointed at how easily they get out of that, what should be like the stickiest of situations. They're in an Imperial base and this guy hauls off and shoots one of their officers. Yeah, that should be much harder thing to escape from, but they go out a window, climb one floor, and they're out. I don't know.
That was the plan. Well, not the shooting the way out, but just getting out and onto the roof. That was the whole plan.
For sure. So maybe we should get into the recap.
But before we do, who is the believer?
That's a good question. My feeling coming out of the episode is that Mando is the believer, and this is a bit of a, like, not completely ironic, but like the title is meant to point out that the believer is something that is not altogether good. You know, with as much as they do with Bill Burr's, Mayfeld's, like, oh, things get messy and you start bending the rules, and how in this episode he's forced to just straight up break one of his rules, taking his helmet off. You know, he starts by bending it and then he eventually breaks it in order to accomplish this mission. That to me was like the ironic part of the believer.
I think I interpret it kind of in the Mayfield character, like rekindling some kind of belief in something. Like, you know, he's a very Han Solo-ish character, and, you know, like Han Solo and very, very much in A New Hope didn't give a shit about anything except for making money, keeping himself out of the carbonite block. And then he got sucked into the idealism, you know, because he's essentially a good guy and he didn't think good guys were left in the galaxy. And then he runs into the crew with them. I kind of thought, but you're right. The Mandalorian trying to figure out what he believes in, like what does fundamentally make him different from Mayfield? What is special about his code of honor? Is this code of honor special, or is him, his own sense of morality and what he does with it, is what makes him special?
And is adhering to any broad ideology like this an inherently bad thing? You know, like the believer implies a sort of blind faith as well.
You're right.
And I think he's getting at, right?
Yeah, the title wasn't Truster in Well-Found Evidential Arguments and Logical Constructs. You know, that's a believer is, you're right, Santa Claus. You believe in Santa Claus. You don't prove him, you believe in him. That's a good take, yeah.
So that was my take, but I like yours as well. Makes a lot of sense by the end of this episode.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood. so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Okay, we start off this episode with Cara Dune using her new status as Marshal to get Mayfeld out of his labor camp, and they tell him the situation and what they need from him, the coordinates for Moff Gideon's ship. He's going to need to access an internal Imperial terminal, which is a mouthful, on Morak in order to do that. So they fly there.
I thought the penal planet, what'd you think of the design? I thought it was really cool.
I just love seeing all these scrap junked TIE fighters, like all these cockpits that are so recognizable,
half torn apart AT-AT walkers, and then AT-AT walkers being repurposed to cranes, which I think they might have just reused the model from the ocean planet a couple back. It is weird because they are leaning real hard in the New Republic kind of being dystopian, like an enlightened civilization doesn't sentence 50 people to 50 years of hard labor. Like, that's something we're trying to figure out in the 21st century. It's like, isn't this just slavery with extra steps? You got someone confined. It's supposed to be a rehabilitative justice, but we're going to squeeze slave labor out of them. Like, that's kind of gross. So that's been a subtext in Star Wars for a long time. But now they're kind of making it text. Like, the New Republic, at least the one trying to rebuild after the galaxy's in flames, is not necessarily the Enlightened, and maybe the Republic never was, because the Republic allowed the Outer Rims to kind of do what they wanted and have human slaves and that kind of stuff. Like, it really kind of fucks with your idea of what the good guys are. It's honestly impressively moral gray area for like what's essentially a kid show.
That's the stuff I liked about this episode. And you know, the Imperial officer Hess also talks a little bit about that, right? How the New Republic is sort of, or the forming New Republic is in disarray, and they are the Empire is rebuilding. I don't know. This is all from his perspective, so you have to take it with a grain of salt. Like, that might be how he sees it.
He seems like a real piece of shit, even by Imperial commander standards.
But then we know what, you know, a few years from now is going to look like, courtesy of the movies.
Right.
And it's not exactly New Republic ruling the galaxy and peace among all peoples. So,
which is fairly, I mean, that's the thing. Like, most revolutions do end in chaos and disarray and some kind of authoritarian regime. So, you got to kind of be careful what you wish for. Are you surprised / impressed that Boba Fett touched up his paint? before in between missions.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what technology he has that allowed him to clean this armor up so well, but holy moly, he looks good.
Yeah.
Better than he ever looked in Return of the Jedi.
Oh, yeah. It looked like he just opened up the Kenner package, man. Yeah. This is like some 45-year-old sweaty nerds had the in-the-box prototype Boba Fett ready to go.
Yeah, looks good. There was also a different version of the theme in this episode, the theme song, which I liked. It was a little more upbeat, a little more, a little stronger. It felt good.
Well, I also really liked the idea that, like, we were like, what the fuck do you need the Imperial Sharpshooter for? Well, it's because he's got the codes and clearances. Do you believe that those things are still active, like, 6 years later? I don't know, but it's a pretty, yeah, I mean, you know, this stuff, better shows and movies than The Mandalorian have done similar kind of schemes. So I thought it was fine.
Yeah, no
also,
problem.
Really love seeing the inside of the, you know, because you always know that like Slave One's got this weird rotating configuration of landing and flying and all that kind of stuff. And seeing that like the interior of it all rotate, just like the incredible cross section showed us like 20 years ago. I thought that was pretty gratifying to see all that work. I thought it was cool, the interior.
Yeah, it's like the Star Wars equivalent of a crash couch from The Expanse, right?
Yeah. And now that we talked about that, since we talked about that volume last week, I feel like I see that everywhere. That was clearly the volume set, that that the platform and their seats and everything was physical. But I could just tell that was that volume LED generated background kind of rotating with them. Nifty effect, though.
Nice. So they get to Morak, and it is heavily protected. None of them can go inside because they'll all be scanned and recognized for one reason or another, except for Mando, who says, I'm going to go in. You're not going in without me. But he won't be showing his face somehow. And the somehow is they attack one of these transports. They take the armor and helmets from the drivers, and we'll get to the rest of it.
I did like the debate about who's going to go, because Cara Dune's like, yeah, I'll go. And he's like, well, if they see your bio scan, they might. I'm like, what about her fucking rebel teardrop tattoo? You think that might be a problem sneaking into an Imperial base? You think they got to do a DNA scan, or do you think that's just going to give her away? You know, like, come on, man.
Fair.
And then, like I said, Fett's Boba, like, yeah. Let's just say they might recognize my face. I do.
Hilarious.
A lot of kind of like Star Wars lore that people might not be familiar with. This Rhydonium is an explosive compound that was introduced in, like many other concepts in the show, the Clone Wars and Rebels. It's described as a very unstable, like explosive compound. It's supposed to look like liquid metal or like liquid chrome. Yeah. We never see it out of its tanks, but you can clearly see how explosive it was.
It sets up an opposite of speed action scene here. Like, we can't go above a certain mile per hour, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And these little tin wheel vehicles are based on this juggernaut concept. So back in Empire Strikes Back, Lucas wanted this big, you know, battle between the rebels and the Imperials. And he commissioned a whole bunch of people to do concept art. And it's not Ralph McQuarrie, but Joe Johnson, one of the other, you know, great granddaddies of Star Wars look and feel, designed these things as an alternative to AT-AT Walker. George Lucas went with those, and these things only existed. And like, I remember them being listed in like the, like as an old Clone Wars era technology in the old West End, role-playing games in the late 80s and early 90s. And then when they came out the Clone Wars, George Lucas decided, oh yeah, let's bring these back. These don't look exactly like, and I looked it up on Wikipedia. There's like 8 different variants of the juggernaut, because every time they bring him into the Clone Wars or the Rebels, like, they don't get the model exactly right, and you gotta have a separate Wikipedia entry. These apparently are very lightly armed transport versions of those juggernauts. They're based on this early concept art. But I thought they're cool. My son's got a juggernaut model from the Clone Wars as a Lego. That he put together a couple years ago. It's pretty cool, and it looked it's a neat looking model in motion.
I found out that the Rhydonium was in the Clone Wars. It was used as a weapon to try and blow up a conference between like a bunch of Jedi and New Republic leaders, or old Republic leaders. Yeah, that'd probably be right. So it was you know, it featured pretty heavily in an episode called Point of No Return. At least that's what I found in my research, because I've not seen that. But if you want to check out Rhydonium, there you go.
They also have a nice like introduction to like the idea that Mayfield might not be entirely over his Imperial sympathies, because, you know, there's this question about, you seem to know a lot about how the Imperial Remnant operates. Of course, you know, by the end, all's well that ends well. But I like that injection of like, you know, is this guy, where's the sympathies going to lie, you know?
I mean, they expected him to know a lot about Imperial operations, right? That's why they brought him. But the remnant.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I don't know why that remark made it into the script, because of course he does. Of course.
It is weird that he'd be this current. He knows where the secret bases are, and he knows that the Imperials would be run, the remnant would be run by XISB. You know, maybe he's just keeping his hand in it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like going and putting the team together and then questioning when fucking Don Cheadle knows too much about pinches. You know, it's like, you seem to know a lot about pinches, Mr. Cheadle.
Yeah. You might be a bank robber, you know, Basher. What the hell? I thought you were
Basher. Yeah, so they, like you said, find out that they're towing some dangerous cargo here. They pass some people in a small settlement, and Mayfeld tries to draw some common ground with Mando, or like dig into his belief system here, about how he's like redefining some of his rules now that things are getting messy. And then they see two of the other transports destroyed, and then pirates pull up behind them and start jumping onto their vehicle. So Mando gets out and fights off several waves of them, as they try and blow up the Rhydonium in their cargo hold.
I thought the setup of this action scene didn't make much sense, because they describe these people as pirates.
Uh-huh.
But why do pirates just want to blow up the cargo?
They're not pirating anything.
It'd make more sense if it was some kind of resistance from the village, or if it was like a crack. I thought it'd be interesting if it was going to like a crack Republic rebel commando team.
Yes, that would be great.
Would cause a lot more moral ambiguity about like, what do you got to do about the situation? But they're like, oh, it's pirates. That's a amoral outfit. But they also they do piracy. They don't do suicide material denies. It's much more like a rebel / terrorist attack, depending on whether, you know, your sympathies lie with the Empire or the rebels. So it's like one of those things where it's like, that's what I meant by messy. You know, in a show that actually took some of this stuff, the geopolitical stuff, more serious, that would have a better explanation. But this show, it's like fucking pirates. So taste them all, blow them up. It doesn't matter. You can crunch them. You can run over them with tin wheels. It doesn't matter. They don't need to have a coherent objective or mission, you know, that they have to complete. They're just there to blow shit up and cause chaos.
But it seems like an easy and superior change to just, like you said, put them as rebels, because then you lean right into the questions about this. And it seems like later, when, because they're about to get saved, right? TIE fighters fly in this episode, in this scene, and save their ass from the pirates, who are overwhelming in number. They make it back to the base, and they're given a hero's welcome at the base. And you have to like look at that and say, okay, are they trying to do something where the TIE fighters saving Mando and these people all saluting him and getting the hero's welcome on the Imperial side is equivalent, and there is just as many, you know, innocents, for lack of a better word, on the Imperial side, who are just doing their jobs, don't know any better, have bought into an ideology that, you know, that they didn't come to, you know, through any thought of their own. You know, both sides of this are having problems, right? And they're being killed by the other side. And you could tie that in so nicely in an episode where they're clearly trying to do that. Why not make it a little more obvious?
If this was less YA, you could do that kind of, but like, you got a problem with the Mandalorian, you know, Din and Cara Dune would have a fucking conniption fit if they were forced to kill a bunch of rebel commandos, or worse, innocent villagers are trying to fight for their freedom. Like, Cara's going to sit there in a sniper rifle and just watch the Mando have to paste 30 rebel commandos or 30 innocent. That's an interesting moral conundrum.
Right, it's drama. But that is drama.
You are leaving the Saturday morning matinee Flash Gordon, you know, but if you make them pirates, you don't have to worry about it. You can just kill them all and nobody's going to ask questions. Why are they there? What are they trying to accomplish? The adults are asking, but you know what? The 13, 14 year olds and certainly the 8 year olds aren't asking that question. They hear pirates and like, Nando can kill an unlimited number of them. It's a video game.
For sure.
Ooh, what if there's a competing Imperial faction? That's another way they could have done it. They introduced the fact that Moff Gideon is just maybe the most powerful or like, because like, yeah, the Empire falls to shit. There'd be tons of Moffs with their own agendas trying to like take over big fragments of it and scrap together. Why couldn't there be like fighting, intra-fighting amongst the Imperials? Then you got Imperial on Imperial. That'd be kind of cool too.
Surely like Hess knows nothing about Gideon's plans, right? I doubt they're like all on board and in the loop when it comes to
is Moff at the tippy top of, or is Admiral Thrawn that they've talked about, like, you know, is he at the tippy top?
Is there that pyramidic of a structure? Is that their hierarchical structure, or is it just like, you know, this thing has been flattened, this power structure where, like you said, all these factions are just.
Is Snoke? I got Snoke that running things right now. Is Snoke already? Is he come out of the clone pits of Palpatine and is starting to puppet things?
I don't know the timeline on that, but maybe.
I mean, it's 15 years early, but you know, Snoke looked like he'd been around, and of course, he's also a clone. Like that's who the fuck knows? Let's not think too hard about it.
For sure. So they make it into this Imperial base, and they find a terminal in the officer's mess. Unfortunately, there's a guy that Mayfeld used to work with named Valen Hess in the room, and Mando decides, okay, well, if Mayfeld can't go in, I got to go in and access the terminal myself. And he has to take his helmet off in the process, cause it's got to scan his face. So over the course of this, adventure, Hess gets suspicious and starts asking Mando some questions. So Mayfeld comes in to answer him and saves Mando's bacon. Unfortunately then Hess invites them for a drink.
So I have a couple of questions about this scene, like a couple of minor ones and then maybe a major discussion we can have. First off is like, am I crazy or do I remember in the end of season one that the Mandalorian and Moff Gideon have a bit of personal history? Like I thought that like when he was outside the canteen or whatever, taunting, you know, Mandalorian and Cara Dune and I can't remember.
Grief and...
Baby
Yoda.
And Baby Yoda and shit. IG 11 might have even been there too.
Yeah.
I thought he had some personal information he taunted them all with. Like he had some kind of knowledge of them. I didn't think much of it, but then the Mandalorian goes to an Imperial scan, code terminal, takes off his helmet and is facial scanned. And is this like a. Does this hint that the Mandalorian did some, it was an ex-Imperial, did some Imperial work in his past?
It's a good question. Like, why would this system allow him after a facial scan to access anything? Unless he were in the Imperial database as an ally of some kind.
Or is it supposed to, you're supposed to understand that this is more of like a security thing where it's like, it just logs a person's photos so that people can go back. Like, I don't know why in a galaxy, you know, with the technology that he got, they couldn't do like biometric kind of like a soft code thing.
Well, they clearly do because Cara Dune would have her face scanned and recognized as a Republic Marshal. So like
you would think
they absolutely have the facial recognition technology. What they don't do apparently is scan you to make sure that you are in the database. As an Imperial, they just scan you to make sure you're not in the database as a rebel. Like,
yeah, if you're a registered rebel, then that's no good. But a Mandalorian who's never been registered because he's never shown his face, he just like is a blank. But it could also be a measure that like where they take a, and I'm wondering, like they take a picture of the code. Like, yeah, why do they even need Mayfield? Because the Mandalorian could just walk up there and, you know, put in a stick and take his helmet off and get access. It didn't seem like he needed codes or whatever. Maybe the other thing is it's a security measure after the fact that like, you know, if you, it's part of an audit log and Moff Gideon's going to do what with that? Because it's not like the Mandalorian has a secret identity.
I mean, he sends him a taunting message at the end of this, right? Like he's just a kid, right? As far as,
but it's he's not like Batman. And if Moff Gideon finds out he's actually Din Djarin, that like, that's going to compromise him, right? Like he's just a Mandalorian that never takes his face off or never takes his mask off,
right? Everybody knows he's a Mandalorian and he's been a Mandalorian since he was a baby or a very young child, so like What could he possibly reveal by that? I don't think you're supposed to think too hard about any of this stuff. It's just like the tension here is, are they going to get access to this data? And however it happens, whatever they want to write here is just how it goes.
Okay. Because I was thinking like, oh, maybe they're going to introduce some kind of like ex-Imperial stuff, or, you know, is this going to be something that's screwed? But I couldn't really figure it out. The other thing is something I noticed that Alan Sepinwall had a problem with in his review is he thought that the Mandalorian taking his mask off is fairly anticlimactic. And as a person who grew up in a weird religious cult himself, I found this to be a very natural outcropping of someone who, like, is, you know, like, if you've been told your entire life that your honor, your masculinity, your worth as a warrior is tied into this armor and you're wearing it, the first time you take it off is, you know, like in duress, you're probably expecting to lose all that.
Yep.
And, you know, like the first, it's like, it's harder to break that first rule. And then when you find out that, oh shit, lightning didn't fall from heaven, I still, you know, I'm still capable of having honor and holding my, and protecting the people that I love and keeping my word, that like this, like almost like this mask thing is a silly deal. And as he gets exposed to other Mandalorians that don't have any problem with it, like I felt like, It would be weird if he just took his helmet off and like, well, I'm just done. Like, hey, turns out I can just take my helmet off and I'm just done with it. You know, he is violating his culture's norms, but it felt like that's exactly how it would go down. And then he, you know, what did you think?
Yeah, I love how it's how the belief, you know, the believer in him, this faith is tied to this physical aspect of their religion, which, you know, it's a lot of physical aspects of religion, crosses, rosaries, a lot of stuff goes along with those. But once you're, forced to, in a moment of duress, like you said, give up or at least temporarily suspend that portion of your belief, how does it change you? What cracks in your belief system does that open? And how long does it take before those cracks turn into holes that you can now see the world through? And I think they started this smartly with Bo-Katan back, you know, a few episodes ago, where she's just like, yeah, we're Mandalorians too. And we take our helmets off. You've got this weird hang up that's given to you by just the particular sect of this belief system that you were, you know, not born into, but taken into. As someone who has personal experience with that and knows people like you who did strongly believe those things, you've told me experiences about how your first experience with like particular thought patterns or books in particular are like moments that didn't change your worldview, right? But they opened those cracks. They said, okay, they put question marks after everything.
It was a continuum of like, it wasn't just like you go through this moral event horizon and just be like, oh, fucking Katie barred a door. Like the horse is out of the barn. Who cares now? It's more of like, oh, God, that was scary. I'm going to go back. But then like in the back of my mind, well, shit, maybe that's not maybe I've been lied to my whole life kind of.
Or did doing that make me a worse person? Like that hasn't changed anything fundamentally about me. It's just simply a thing that I wasn't doing before that now I do. And so,
right. Exactly.
Yeah. I think they're doing a lot of fairly smart stuff and it's very subtle. You know, despite Mayfeld here talking about the lines you don't cross and how things get messy and you suddenly bend your rules, there's a lot of that, but even the stuff they're doing around the physical, just taking his helmet off, is pretty subtle and pretty smart.
Yeah, and it also that scene reminded me a lot of there's a scene in the upcoming release of The Expanse where Amos Burton, who's kind of a Mandalorian type character himself, is talking to somebody and someone says, you can't judge a person by what they do when they're trying to make rent. And Amos said, actually, yeah, you can. Because he's thinking like maybe you steal a mouth of bread, maybe you steal $5 from a rich person, but they're also like, you know, you can sell children into slavery. You can murder innocent people. Like you can judge people by a lot.
You can be
murdering. I thought that was interesting. Yeah, exactly. And I felt like that was, you know, it Mayfield felt a lot like Han Solo, that he is this guy who thought that the universe is bereft of people doing the right thing, that every, you know, like he's firmly believed in one thing and then he saw the other side and it's full of shit. And the idea that, you know, you can be kind of a good guy just kind of out here in the galaxy that never occurred to him before, to make a clean break with this past. I thought all that stuff was really interesting.
Yeah, we should talk about that scene because we get a quick shot of
I want to just really, because like this always comes up whenever we talk about that. Like if you want to know like the cult background, baldmove.com/about. We got a whole series of Q&A and podcasts if you want to delve into that. But
So there's more really good stuff here, and we can get some background on Mayfield in this next scene. There's Karen Finnick up on the hilltop just kind of scouting the place out. Very quick scene. And then we go back to Hess drinking with the heroes, right? Or, you know, whatever Mayfield is. Mayfield can't keep his thoughts to himself on this operation, this mission that he went on or was part of or was just there for. I'm not sure of his involvement, but it's Operation Cinder, where a lot of people, 5,000 to 10,000 Imperials plus a bunch of freedom fighters, were just destroyed when Hess did some really heinous shit. And you know, he can't keep his thoughts to himself, so he ends up shooting this guy, and you know, they're chased out onto the ledge, they're chased up to the rooftop where Boba Fett comes by with the Slave One and picks them up while Kara and Finnick are holding the stormtroopers off their back. There's a pretty good scene, which is the turn with Mayfield here, where Hess is just an unwashed, unrepentant asshole. Thinks, you know, that there's some greater good the Imperials are doing around providing order in the galaxy. You know, it's Star Wars shit. It's a philosophy that we've seen from them. And Mayfield, having seen the destruction that took place there firsthand, can't tolerate that worldview anymore. And he puts a blaster bolt in this guy. And I think that to me is interesting because apparently this Operation Cinder thing is part of this whole contingency plan. I think it's called the contingency in Star Wars that the Emperor had for when he was dead. It's just slash and burn everything. Just the Imperials have failed to protect me and keep me alive. So fuck them. We're taking them out. The rebels obviously have done their deeds and killed me. So fuck them, take them out. And this was part of that whole thing, which was executed right after the Battle of Endor. And that to me betrays like the difference between some true philosophy where you just sort of believe in the thing and then this maniacal demagogue worship of the Emperor, because at that point, like, you're killing your own people, right? There is no more the greater good order. Now it's, you're just instilling chaos in the galaxy. And even the heinous shit that I think the stuff that I label as heinous about the Imperials falls apart in that moment where they're destroying themselves. Just because their emperor died, like that's not a reason. Like, you are worshiping that god at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, it was chilling. It's also the rare Imperial officer that has like a Southern drawl. Usually they got the like the, you know, the prissy English kind of very kind of posh accent. That was a deliberate choice. Like, Lucas wanted the bad guys to be kind of like these arch, you know, prim and proper villains, and the rebels were the ones that kind of had the American accents that were a little bit more Yankee doodle dandy. So I thought it was interesting that they broke with that tradition for this guy. It's not the first time. They've also had other Imperials that didn't exactly do that. But I thought that was interesting.
And I like the stuff with Mando too, where he, you know, puts his helmet back on and Mayfield's like, I never saw your face. You did what you had to do. You know, this is Mando making exceptions. This is my big question coming out of this is, how far will they go with this? Will they take this all the way, or will they take this really dark? I seriously doubt they're going to take this super dark where Mando suddenly is committing atrocities on the scale of Operation Cinder or something. But like, are they going to take Mando all the way from Mandalorian to non-believer? Right. Or just like, where are they going to go with that? I'm super curious.
I do think eventually, like, probably the next season they'll find a way to have him off with his helmet off more often than not. He'll be kind of like more of a reasonable Mandalorian, but it'll take time. You know, like I said, I think as much as like Alan Sepinwall had a problem with the fact that it wasn't like a binary on off switch, I would have had a problem the opposite direction if he's just like, yeah, fuck it. I guess I gotta take my helmet off. So even though that's the thing, it's like his faith says like once you take it off, you can't ever put it back. It's not like you can't take it off. You can leave the path anytime. You just can't, like, once you do, you can't get back on. Also, there's not lightning that falls from heaven if you do. So what does that mean?
I mean, this is cult shit, right? Like, exactly. They tell you not to read the literature from other religions. Don't go seeking out that sort of information.
Twist it up.
And they say you can't do it, right? You can't do it. Mm-hmm. And if you do it, it's an awful, horrible thing. Turns out once you do it, You can just turn your brain off and go right back to what you were doing before. It's not a light switch.
Minor infractions and stuff. Like, you know, if you say you can't smoke or whatever and you have your first cigarette, and it turns out I didn't turn evil. I'm not infested by demons.
And
whatever.
I hated smoking and I'm not going to go back to it. So I guess I'm just still in this thing. Yeah.
I do want to, a couple of other things I thought were funny is that this action all happens in the officer's mess. And I'm like, oh, come on. Like, shouldn't these officers be throwing shit at these stormtroopers walking into their private mess hall? But they established that both of the juggernaut drivers were like, Bill Burr identifies himself. Mayfield identifies himself as a lieutenant. And he says, this is my commanding officer. So they got officers crewing these transport stuff. Like,
wow.
You'd think that's like the kind of enlisted type stuff that you would do.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I guess it's funny. It's like I thought that I was going to get him in one thing, but like turns out, apparently everyone's just an officer. It's like a Federation vessel where like everyone's a fucking officer. Also, did you catch the reference to TPS reports?
No.
Yeah, as Mayfield is trying to get him away, say, hey, we got to go fill out those TPS reports so we can change out the reactors. It's an office space gag, which I thought was pretty funny.
I like that they had Mayfield use his sharpshooting abilities before we left him. He takes out that right away.
They didn't need him for that, but he distinguished himself. My question is, I do think he had a bit of a change of heart. Like he didn't quite buy his own bullshit. But also, do you think in the back of his mind, he thinks like, hey, if I blow up this Imperial facility, that's going to look really good to Marshal Dune over here.
He's got a thing for her, right? Am I wrong about that?
I don't think he has a thing. I think he's just busting her ovaries, her lady balls. Like when he's like, you know, oh, you're, I don't know. Like, would he say no if she gave him the raised eyebrow? But like thing, I don't know.
Yeah. Either way, they don't make anything of it. I will say also the weapon that Boba Fett uses, Slave One weapon, these seismic charges are super cool. I mean, they look amazing.
Yeah. The banjo kablooies is what I like to call them.
If you don't remember, he didn't use these. Jango used these back in Attack of the Clones when Obi-Wan was falling into Geonosis.
Gave him a real hard time in that asteroid field with those sonic. I think they're sonic mines canonically.
Yeah, they're like seismic charge sort of things.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's a really cool action scene when it happens in the movies. So. Mm-hmm. I like seeing those again. So after they get to safety, Carr decides to let Mayfield go, and Mando, we find out he did get the coordinates.
Does he just wander off into the jungle? Like, okay, great. I'm on an oppressed, primitive hut world with no plausible way out other than walking back to the Imperials. So I guess it's better. I mean, it is objectively better than the penal planet he was on.
But, yeah, they could have given him a ride. I don't know. Maybe he's learned in his labor camp days to.
You got a nice crew going on here. You got the big bad Boba. You got Finnick. You got Kara. You got the Mandalorian. You got Grogu. You got an honest to God crew. If you bring another guy on that you can now trust and maybe he feels a certain amount of gratefulness to, and if you know if he steps out of line, you could always throw him back in prison.
Fair.
So,
I mean, maybe that happens after, you know, Boba Fett makes good on his pledge and goes off to do his own thing, and he needs
like
a ship.
A week, I was thinking, like, also maybe a week from now he gets trench foot or whatever the Star Wars equivalent in the jungle and just dies. He dies of dengue fever and space malaria. And
sure, the last episode.
The stormtroopers have to go through like a round of six shots to protect you from all the bad shit that can eat you on this planet, and he just didn't have any of that stuff. So
yeah, why
bad
would
news.
He?
Don't drink the water. Don't drink the water, Bill.
All right. Yeah, so Mando did get the coordinates to Gideon, and then we see Gideon getting a message from Mando telling him, I'm coming for you. I'm coming for Grogu. That's my baby.
I mean, isn't this a wild thing to do?
Yeah. Yeah. But
like Alan Sepinwall said, he's like, it's a sick wrestling promo, which I thought was funny. It's like, what are you going to do when Mando Mania blasts all over you, Gideon? I'm coming for you. Like, why would you do this? Like, I guess it's not a surprise that he would, but I don't think that, I don't know that Moff Gideon necessarily assumed that like Mando had fallen, has loves this thing like his child. He might think, well, you know, the bounty hunter, he's trying to hold this, or he had a better offer, or he has some other inscrutable. But now going like, this is the most important thing in the universe, and I'm coming for you, and you better expect that. Like, why would you do that other than the fact that this is a Saturday morning cereal that you're not really supposed to take too serious?
Right. I mean, that's the real reason. It's also hilarious, though, that now Gideon knows he has an excellent hostage as well. It's not just that he has, you know, potentially the unlocking of the Force clones, whatever he's trying to do, but like, yeah, now he's got a hostage. Put a gun to baby Grogu's head and
That's gonna happen. It's gonna put a gun to baby Grogu's head, and it's gonna be
put a dark saber to it.
Speaking of Grogu, didn't get a sniff of baby Yoda this episode. I think this is the only episode of the Mandalorian that you do, because like even in the first episode you saw his like little claw popping out. Like there is no little tiny hand in a blue glowing manacle. Nothing. Nope. Nothing. No shot of him lonely and afraid. I thought we'd get that, like him kind of whimpering in a cell to like really, you know, make us really want to get Moff Gideon's ass kicked up between his ears. But nope. No Grogu at all.
Saving it all for the finale. I don't even know where they go with the finale. I don't think it's too quick for them to just say, okay, well, they got to Gideon now, so they're fighting to get Grogu back. No. Too soon.
It would seem, I mean, I'm not going to set expectations to just be dashed, but yes.
Yeah.
Like even with a monster for this show standard 60-minute episode, it's going to be hard to catch up and assault a sawed off Star Destroyer's worth of dudes. Yeah. Even with this badass, I mean, I can already see like how amazing it's going to be for both of these, everyone fighting at their full potential, but still, there has to be. I was thinking, like, what is the plan here with the calling him out with the wrestling promo? There's like, you're gonna bait him into making a mistake. Like the mistake would be to leave your heavily defended impregnable starship. Like so.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the angle here?
Like, I feel like Cara Dune is gonna get involved. Like, call in some of the New Republic right now that she's a marshal. Call them in to put them on the hunt of Gideon too, because they want his ass.
That's true. And also you already had the X-Wing Marshal, Marshal X-Wing was already talking about how they're, you know, looking for a case to prove the Imperial Remnant is active. Like, she's got a hell of a case. She saw the refinery. They got firsthand testimony of the fact that these guys have got something big planned with the heavy explosives, that they're going to do something that makes Operation Cinder look like, I don't know what he exactly, a Star Wars firecracker. They got Moff Gideon that stolen this high midichlorian dude and like, you know, doing experiments with them. Like, yeah, you might be right. Like, that would be kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Like a New Republic strike team coming in and joining forces. But still, like,
and use
an
it
hour.
As a distraction or something. It's a good question. I don't know, man.
I feel like it might be a close call. But I do feel like it's going to be a while before baby Yoda's back in the arms of the Mandalorian, unfortunately.
Yeah, and we could be totally wrong, but we'll see. We'll see in 1 week.
Yeah.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We have feedback this week, you know? People send it in to mando@baldmove.com. They send us hyperspace messages, and we receive them. You can also discuss it with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com if you care to. First up, Brett H. I know you guys haven't watched the animated Clone Wars series. Not all of it. I have watched all four of those Mandalorian episodes, and I've watched a couple others as I've had time. But not all seven episodes of that and Rebels or seven seasons. I hadn't either, but I kept hearing about Easter eggs and more backstory and some of the things that we were seeing in The Mandalorian. So I did a Google search on important Clone Wars episodes, so I didn't have to watch all 120 of them. In the second season, a young Boba Fett tries a couple of times to kill Mace Windu. We never see Mace die in Return Revenge of the Sith. Could we see an exiled Mace answer Grogu's call? I would assume he would know who Grogu is. Then when he does, Boba Fett is faced with the dilemma of avenging his father or maintaining his promise to Mando to help retrieve Grogu from Moff Gideon. Seems too perfect. I'm not sure how they kept Sam Jackson's involvement a secret, but a Star Wars fanboy can dream, eh?
You're not wrong.
We didn't see, you're right.
We saw him electrocuted and then fall.
His hand gets cut off. He gets electrocuted and then blown out of a Coruscant window, which we've seen multiple Jedis in that movie series get blown out of Coruscant high skyscraper windows and be okay.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you've seen people chopped in half. You've seen people fall down shafts all the time and they come back. So why not?
Did anyone know about Tamaria Morrison before the season started up? Because I wonder how hard it would be to keep Sam Jackson's involvement, like if he just came in to film a cameo or something. Or, you know, the thing is, since we got so little time, this could be a next season plot even.
Yeah.
I actually think it's got legs, and it'd be cool as hell.
And it makes total sense for Boba Fett. Like, he's going to hold a grudge, right? Like, he killed his dad, you know? It's a thing.
Plus, you know, the prequels are like 20 years ago. The timeline, like Sam Jackson aging naturally into the role, I think would, you know, that would actually work somehow.
Here's how you keep it a secret, though. They kept Baby Yoda a secret, remarkably. Like, nothing of Baby Yoda leaked, no matter how cute Sam Jackson turns out to be 20 years on. they can keep him a secret if he's digital. So you don't have to bring Sam Jackson back. You can just make a digital version of him. Then there's no actor to leak anything. There's no pages.
Yeah. That's the key with Grogu. He didn't have a trailer on a studio backlot. He wasn't going driving in and out.
No makeup person says, hey, I did up Mace Windu's scar tissue. No.
Yeah. He's got Frank Oz's right hand. You got to keep it quiet. And that's...
Yep.
Do we know who I need to finish all of the behind the scenes on this, but like, do we know? Cause I know sometimes Grogu's a puppet and sometimes he's a CG thing.
Mm.
Most of the time he's a puppet. It's not Frank running that, is it? He's old. Frank Oz. Yeah,
Frank Oz is a million years old. If not recently dead.
Oh my God. Did Frank Oz die? No, surely not. No, he's 76. He's only 76 years old.
Oh, wow. That's younger than I expected.
Yeah, I thought he was older in Empire, but he must have been kind of like in his 30s, I guess. That checks, because all the Henson crew was pretty young back in the 70s, you know, like that was kind of a motley hippie crew. So
for sure.
Maybe he is. Maybe that is the right hand of Oz up Baby Grogu's bunghole. Let's see. Charles. Hey, fellas, I love all your numerous podcasts. Thanks, Charles. Appreciate it. Just thought I'd weigh in with some fun facts regarding a couple of minor gripes that you had with the tragedy episode of Mando. While I agree it's dumb that Boba and Mando bend over to shoot their rocket, it is actually a little Easter egg and lets you know the double Fs are just putting the toys they grew up with on their screen. The old Boba Fett action figure would have to bend over to shoot his rocket. Now, I remember watching a couple years ago The Toys That Made Us, which is this like Netflix show, and they went in all about the Kenner thing. And my understanding was this Boba Fett jetpack that actually launched was like a prototype that never actually got made till years later. And maybe if you bend him over, that's what actuates. But I thought it had a little switch on his back, you know?
Yeah, but to aim him at anything, you'd have to bend him over, right?
Well, yeah, I guess.
Otherwise, just shoot straight up in the air.
Right. But that's not like because Boba Fett had to. If true, or to the extent that this is true, that is kind of cute and charming.
Yeah.
But I will maintain it does make the grown ass men doing it look ridiculous. So.
Sure.
But anyway, also that I was aiming for the other ship is an homage to Magnificent Seven when James Coburn was congratulated for shooting a rider as he flees and says I was aiming at his horse. I saw that and I don't know. I think that I've seen this particular joke six or seven times in movies and television shows to establish like a kind of a sloppy or gaunt, slightly deceived badass. In exactly the same way they do it in the Magnificent Seven. So I didn't mention it, but enough people did that I thought, well, I might as well. He also didn't accidentally shoot someone's horse and the other horse creamed into it and blew them both up.
I mean, that might be the genesis of that joke.
Yeah, true. True enough. Josh F. says, shame on the people fat shaming Boba Fett. I guess I'm included in that. I feel like as a husky guy myself, I get to poke fun at the... people, but I'm not even poking fun. I just think it's cool. Like, thick Boba Fett, I think is like Tamara Morrison, even as a middle-aged man with a little bit of a paunch looks powerful.
Yeah. You know, sure.
And I grew up in an era where heavyweight boxers kind of looked like him, you know, like you got show muscle and go muscle. And if you got like sub 5% body fat, you're not going to be able to last 10 rounds with some guy pounding on you. And exerting, you got to have those fat stores. So like, yeah, I wasn't really making fun of him, but he says that there's some people that were really, I guess, upset online about the fact that Boba Fett had gotten fat, but like, you know, it happens. Still a badass, still got the Beskar, still got the jetpack, still got the rocket pack, still can fucking wreck shop with a gaffy stick. So I guess that's the point, is like, how did he get that well fed, spending his time in the belly of a sarlacc and wandering the desert?
Yeah, fair question. But he did.
Look at Jabba. Jabba wanders the desert, fat as shit. Gamorrean guards spend time with the Jabba's palace, fat as hell.
It's true.
I feel like there's a lot of tubbies. A lot of tubbies on Tatooine. There's the Empire. Sure. The Empire always publishes the top 20 fattest planets. You know, kind of like you always see the Americans like Tatooine's always at the top of the list. There's just poor eating habits. Those moisture farmers.
Yeah, Uncle Owen
can't afford.
Uncle Owen, not a skinny Uncle man. Owen. He's sucking moisture out of the atmosphere to survive. He's still tubby. So come on.
I think he's pumping the moisture out. Like, you know, he's like, when you get that much girth, that much robes, you generate the moisture yourself.
Sure. The moisture farmers need something to to get.
He needs a moisture collector in his crotch. I guarantee there's some swamp that can be that could be dehumidified there. As a hefty man that lives in a hot summertime climate myself.
I
guess it's dry in the desert.
The underwear tech in Star Wars would be much better than it is now. Like that moisture wicking fabric would be on point. But then there's the counterexample of Mayfeld, who has to put on a soggy stormtrooper outfit because
it's true.
The driver just is a moist man, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know what they're doing with the moisture. The moisture mechanics in this universe don't add up. That's my biggest gripe about Star Wars.
Damn straight. Estuary planet, got estuary groins.
Show me the land on the estuary planet.
Josh F. concludes, we should just enjoy our thick boy Boba while we have him, and also it makes Boba Fett easier to cosplay. Damn straight. I actually think this is a really cool cosplay opportunity. I like the kind of slightly robed turtle, like a sloppy turtleneck, but still recognizably badass Boba Fett. That's like it, yeah. Yeah, it's also, man, that's actually kind of smart because you got a lot of, I'm in like the first generation of Star Wars fans. We're getting old, getting out of shape. Mm-hmm. I don't want to suck in my gut where I'm wearing Boba Fett armor. Yeah, I want a bathrobe that I just strap a vest onto, hang out my gut and just kind of walk around and menace people. That's what I want to be able to do with my cosplay. I'm with you, Josh. Moving on to Chris from Melbourne. Just want to point out the poop technology that Fett has installed in Finnick Shand already exists today right now in today's society. He linked to a e-zine called theconversation.com, and the title of this article is Blending Science, Art, and Other Excrement. Belgian artist Wim de Voile's Cloaca is a machine that simulates the human gastrointestinal system, and a full-scale version is located in the Museum of Old and New Art, the Mona, in Tasmania, Australia. The machine is fed a regular human meal, think like a sandwich and a Coke, each day by the museum cafe, and like clockwork at 2 p.m. every afternoon, it defecates, takes a dump, drops the kids off at the pool, takes a shit, whatever you want to call it. You need to get to the exhibit about 30 minutes before if you want to get a front row seat for the action. The evacuation action. It's museum's most hated piece of art, but also the most visited.
First of all, that you called it Australia when we're talking about the excrement machine that they've created.
Yeah, I was ahead of the joke wave on it, Jim.
God.
Yeah. So apparently Fett just put a scale, because this thing looks like a nightmare. It looks like some kind of blend of H.R. Geiger's Alien Queen technology plus, I don't know, a soft serve machine. It is really gross.
You know what I'm picturing?
And I kind of want to see it.
I'm picturing a more viscous, a more earth-toned version of the water clock that they have at the Children's Museum in Indianapolis.
Yeah. Click on this link. You're not far off. There's a lot of chambers and a lot of hose, a lot of fluids going back and forth. It's and it does make what looks like human shit at the end.
And it tells time.
And it tells time. Yeah, right at 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
You wish you had bowel movements that regular. You wish. 2 p.m. like clockwork. Okay, Tyler. I had to write back for this season of Mandalorian because of how hilarious this podcast has been regarding Star Wars and your commentary on the universe as a whole. Appreciate that.
Oh, yeah.
As a movie-only fan, I've experienced many of my diehard Star Wars friends lecture me on how I should watch all of the Clone Wars cartoons and other Star Wars things to be a true fan.
Gatekeeping bullshit.
And to enjoy Mandalorian to the fullest. I, alongside many others, do not have time for this particular lore and have still highly enjoyed The Mandalorian without that knowledge. Have either of you felt the need to read/watch more to get the most out of the show?
No.
Emphatically no. Now, I have done it because I think that's the expectation, and I do enjoy personally, because I remember like when I saw that thing, like, oh yeah, this is the Juggernaut thing, and I remember seeing that in the role-playing game, and I wonder what the backstory is. That stuff that personally interests me, I think is cool. But I gotta say, don't feel like my enjoyment of the series was improved by watching a couple of hours of the Clone Wars. And I'm not saying like, look, because here's the thing. It's, you definitely know, I think you, it's almost like spoiling yourself, because the more you know about the Mandalorians and his Darksaber stuff and all the Bo-Katan, the more you probably know where the Mandalorian's going. Is that fun? Is that a fun experience? Is it more fun than being a casual Star Wars fan and just kind of being delighted week to week by what's happening and not taking it seriously? Which path is better? I don't know. I think it's enjoyable to be... I've been on both sides of that. Game of Thrones... I was a walking fucking encyclopedia for that. And I read everything. I read all the expanded material. I fucking wrote two books of my own on the subject. Star Wars, I used to be that way. Like, I'd go toe-to-toe with anybody in the galaxy on Star Wars lore up until around circa 2002 or so. And I've fallen off a bit.
Sure.
But, like, I'm still enjoying the hell out of it. And I feel like I'm getting, like, it's... These aren't mysteries of the universe being unlocked on The Mandalorian is the other thing. Like, this is a very easy-to-follow show. It's not much as getting past you, and like if you don't know what the hell's going on with the Darksaber, you will by the time you need to, you know. So
yeah, I do the research around where does my thought train take me when I see what they're trying to do with the episode, and then does my inclination, my interest in the topic direct me? Like I looked up Operation Cinder and some of the you know contingency plan that the Emperor had, because I think it feeds back into how Mayfeld thinks, and that was interesting to me, and so I chased that rabbit. But yeah, I don't go do a lot of looking for, you know, oh, I gotta look up this exact thing in Clone Wars because it was mentioned and I saw it on Reddit and whatever.
Yeah. He concludes, Taylor does, this podcast has been my weekly favorite because I've loved hearing your hilarious comments on Baby Yoda's terrible name, how he has plans to single-handedly destroy the frog people, and your extremely accurate criticisms on the insane emotional problems of the Jedi. I also hope they explore more of what it means to be a normal Jedi who has emotions and attachments and can still be powerful. That's what I'm hoping for. They're going with this Grogu business. P.S. Harry Potter 100% fucked. Not in the movies. It's been a while since I read the books. I guess I need to go read the Harry Potter and the advanced case of puberty.
The Sorcerer's Bone. Yeah.
The Sorcerer's Bone, right? Playing with his wand. Mm-hmm. You can make all the jokes.
Sure.
So I have to go revisit the universe. Nick H. from Sydney. A lot of Aussies in the feed bag this week. Thanks for all your podcasts and make my work days fly. Our pleasure.
Yeah.
Nick. The Mandalorian is still the best Star Wars since the original trilogy, but I am annoyed by how crap the stormtroopers are. Mm-hmm. They can't shoot straight. I suppose they never could. What's the point of their armor? They go down on one shot, and last week Boba Fett was able to smash them with a stick. Oh, wait till you see how Cara Dune takes two of them out just by bumping their heads against a steering wheel. Also just sit there when a boulder is thrown at them. It's starting to annoy me in what is one of the shows of the year. What are your thoughts? Man, if only you were a club member. I went on an amazing rant. I'm going to see if I can do it. Rekindle it. What do you think about this stormtrooper heresy going on here?
Yeah, I think it's to the point of being ludicrous. I don't know. Now I don't like. Look, I never took stormtroopers super seriously, but I did think there was a chance they could at least capture, one of the main heroes or something. Now at this point, if you can just fist fight them, I don't know why I would believe any of that.
Yeah. I have a problem with actually just saying the stormtroopers are canonically crap, because I don't think that's true. If you look at the old trilogy, first of all, clone troopers whip ass. Just can't categorically. Clone troopers are badasses. Stormtroopers, yeah. General Obi-Wan Kenobi, who knew what the fuck he was talking about, says they're very precise and they're very dangerous. When you think of stormtroopers not killing the heroes, you think of opportunities where they have been instructed to allow the heroes to get away. If the stormtroopers had murdered Luke, Leia, and Han, and Vader wasn't able to track them back to the rebel base, they would all have been force choked to death. They were on orders to make it look good, but to let them get away because they wanted to track them back to base. Empire Strikes Back, they fucked shit up. They closed down that shop. The rebels got ran out of their own goddamn gymnasium by these stormtroopers. Not a problem. End of Empire Strikes Back. Again, they were luring Luke to the carbon freezer. They wanted to put on for Luke Skywalker to trap him. They were under orders. Same thing with the Battle of Endor. the stormtroopers are making it look good until the Emperor sprung the trap. Then they started just rolling up the rebels, and the only thing that saved them was Chewbacca in a one in a million shot taking over single-handedly the AT-ST, getting that light armor and turning the tide of the battle. Like, stormtroopers are unfairly maligned throughout the whole, you know. And, you know, again, like, you want to say that, like, oh, they got taken down by teddy bears. Look, you put on your stormtrooper armor and you go up against a black bear with a fucking stone hammer and see how long you last, okay? You know, like yeah. Ewoks are small, but they're like ferocious animals, canonically.
I'm not even sure I could take my house cat. Like, frankly, I've seen it attacking things. I'm not certain. So
most people with stormtrooper armor couldn't take out a 85-pound bobcat, and you're talking shit about Wicket? Get the fuck out of here. Stormtroopers are badass. They've been unfairly maligned, and Dave Filoni and Favreau and all these guys are taking a piss out of them because they think it's a funny joke, and ha-ha, but it's, I don't, yeah.
I thought they had gone too far in season one. Do you remember the scene where the stormtroopers were shooting the shit on their speeder bikes, and like, while Moff Gideon was doing his thing, and they literally could not hit something from 5 feet away? I thought,
right,
this whole fucking scene sucks. Everybody was loving that scene, and just like, oh, yeah, it's the joke. I'm like,
yeah.
The joke was never that they literally couldn't hit anything if they tried.
Right.
It was like, they're not as all they're cracked up to be, if anything. Right.
And right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, like, because it's frustrating because now, because they've made the stormtroopers such a joke, they've had to invent a new class of stormtrooper. Like, well, the all, you know, it's like, sit up and pay attention if a stormtrooper in gloss black armor shows up, because they're the ones that know what to do. That's what the stormtroopers used to be. They were the crack Imperial troops. They had fucking Imperials had a whole arm, you know, like just regular army, you know, like the stormtroopers supposed to be the Space Marines from Warhammer 40K, and the rest of the Imperial army is supposed to be like the Imperial Guard, and they fucked that up. So now they have to have gloss black stormtroopers, so you know that they're the ones that mean business. Most of this rant is in tongue in cheek, because I don't take any of this stuff seriously, but I do think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the original trilogy to think the stormtroopers are garbage, you know. They were mostly, when they were missing their shots, they were supposed to let these people go. And also, you misunderstand the concept of plot armor. If they were able to fucking put one through Luke's O-ring, the goddamn series would be over. Also, kind of hard to take off Force-sensitive people. Have you noticed that? You know?
Yeah, that's true.
They have a trouble going against some of the most powerful Force users in the galaxy. Luke and Leia, the name too. I don't know. It's like I said, I'm not... this is a little tongue-in-cheek, but also you're doing the boys in white dirty.
Yeah, you know, I don't really care that much though. Like,
if I was one of the 501 guys, the 501st Legion that spent $4,000 on a stormtrooper armor, I would be feeling really shitty about what they're doing to me on the Mandalorian. But I don't know. Maybe they love the fact that they're cosplaying as incompetent Nazis. I don't know. All right, Will. With some of the references in Chapter 15, so this builds on what you told us about Operation Cinder. With some of the references in Chapter 15, it seems like the Mandalorian might be loosely following the contingency plan. Now, I want, if you think, like, if you know, you think some expanded universe stuff might spoil your enjoyment of the Mandalorian, this is the last email, so you can shut it off if you don't want to hear any speculation on how these events might tie together, because Will's going to kind of connect the dots for us. This might be loosely following the contingency plan storyline from the Aftermath novels and the Battlefront 2 campaign, which you had mentioned. The Imperial officer's reference to restoring order and Bill Burr's Operation Cinder seemed to point to this. Operation Cinder was a revenge mission by the Empire that took place shortly after destruction of the second Death Star, which used a series of satellites to literally burn planets. The contingency plan was more drawn out and took place mostly in the third Aftermath novel, Empire's End. A brief summary of the contingency plan storyline from Empire's End. Prior to the Battle of Endor, Emperor Palpatine met with one of his top advisors, Gallius Rax. Boy, you don't want to not wear your codpiece when you're around Gallius Rax. It's going to be bad. I know that the armor doesn't protect against much, but you want every bit of it when you're going against Rax here. A Sith acolyte at that. In order to plan for all potential outcomes. Specifically, if the Empire's trap on Endor was to fail, Rax was ordered to go to Jakku and find an observatory that would provide information needed by the remnants of the Empire to navigate beyond the Outer Rim, specifically to the unknown regions, presumably to find ways to resurrect the Emperor as we saw in Rise of Skywalker. Much of this information at the observatory was provided by... Grand Admiral Thrawn. So the reference to him a few episodes is intriguing.
Okay.
Another character. Okay, I'm sorry. Were you about to say something?
No, I was just following. Okay.
Okay. Another character, Grand Admiral Sloane, also plays a large role in the contingency plan. She gathers the bulk of the Imperial fleet and takes them to Jakku for a final stand in order to draw out the remainder of the Republic forces. This final stand culminates with a Sith ritual performed by Rax and another Sith acolyte in the observatory that was meant to destroy the planet and thus the Republic fleet, which would allow the small Imperial expedition to escape to the unknown regions. This destruction of the planet was stopped, Rax was killed, but Grand Admiral Sloane escaped with the expeditionary force and set out for the unknown regions where they began to plan the formation of the First Order. I am curious if the pursuit of Grogu and his blood are part of the plan to resurrect the Emperor, and if the finale shed some light on how the Mandalorian fits in with what else is going on in the galaxy. That's kind of intriguing. I thought it was more like a Dark Trooper plus project, or maybe... clearly Moff Gideon wants to be Darth Vader so hard it's making him vibrate, like, yeah. Maybe like a jump start for him, but like, yeah, cloning the Emperor is another kind of cool possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think the contingency plan explains why the stormtroopers have been so ineffective in the series thus far. The bulk of the elite Imperial forces were eliminated in the final battle on Jakku, and all that's left are scattered forces more or less trying to terrorize the New Republic. Maybe just some headcanon, but it makes the stormtrooper incompetence a bit more bearable. I mean, you take a Marine out of basic training, ask him if he can hit a can of beans from 15 feet away. I'm pretty sure there's got to be a Marine or two listening to this, but it makes you pissed off just thinking about someone thinking that you can't do it, right?
Sure.
Like, stormtroopers just out of basic training should be able to hit a canteen from 15 feet away or whatever the fuck those scout troopers were doing. And I get it. Like, maybe they're not even real stormtroopers. Maybe they're Army Navy surplus stormtroopers just wearing, cause some of that armor look kind of raggedy. But I don't know. I'm still got my blood up a bit about this stormtrooper heresy I'm seeing on this show.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add to,
no.
Operation Cinder?
I hope they connect those dots, cause they sound pretty cool.
And that's the other thing we didn't really talk about, the fact that, like I said, you know, it's been, we didn't talk about this at the beginning, did we? The news we got just yesterday that Walt Disney Corporation is just taking the lever that says Star Wars and cranking it up to 11, baby. We're going to get the Cara Dune and probably the Republic Marshals. Although I don't know if she pisses people off enough with her political beliefs, maybe. I thought it's interesting they got the New Republic Marshals, but it wasn't Cara Dune and the New Republic Marshals. You're going to have Ahsoka with her thing. Apparently, the Obi-Wan Kenobi miniseries is going to get happening. This stuff, like, that's the thing, is like, how much of this is going to happen in The Mandalorian, and how much of this you're supposed to understand is like setting up Thanos in the Marvel Universe, where it's like, you got like, is Admiral Thrawn going to be like the Thanos of the Disney Star Wars side?
He's got almost the coloration for it, sure.
Doesn't have enough of the wrinkly ball sack chin. I know. But I do think it might be a mistake to think that all this is going to be resolved in The Mandalorian, and that they're using The Mandalorian to do a lot of world building.
They for sure are. Which, yeah.
You know, Marvel did that too, and it wasn't, I don't think, a detraction from it, but get ready for 360 or 24, 365 Star Wars coming at you, because that's what's happening.
I hope they have a more cohesive vision for the next 10 years than they did for the movie trilogy or you know, the Star Wars cinematic universe before this.
No, I think the double F's are in pretty good hands. Like, you know, they're the Kevin Feige. How do you pronounce his name? Is it Feige? Feige? I don't know.
I don't know exactly.
Like, the most important thing is you have people that actually give a shit about the universe and have, like, you know, like, I don't agree with their take on stormtroopers, but it still makes me smile, because that's certainly like an inside fan joke about the stormtroopers, you know?
Yeah.
So leaning into that is kind of funny. You know, just like when they take pot shots of how goofy Captain America's costume used to look, you know, like those are things that we can all laugh at and have a good time with. But the real open question is, how much appetite do people have for this? Because mm-hmm. Marvel could get 3 or 4 movies out a year for a decade, and everybody couldn't get enough. But that's what, 10 to 12 hours of content? We're talking 300, you know, like 50, 60 hours of content every year for the rest of our lives. I don't know. I honestly don't. That's unprecedented. It's like, you want a model that looks like that? You got to go to like soap operas, man. And, you know.
Yeah. And if they go with that highly integrated, connected model, you might end up having to watch a lot of it to really get what's going on in any of it. And that's scary when you have that much content.
Yeah. I think they're smart, because like, I never felt that way. I did watch all the Marvel stuff, but I felt like you could like miss Thor 2 and you could miss Iron Man 2 and 3, and you could miss certainly the Incredible Hulk. You didn't have to see them all to get, because like most movies did a good job when they, the first 15 minutes, familiarizing yourself with the stuff you might have missed, introducing new characters, like everything kind of was severable. And I think if Star Wars is smart, they'll do that, because like, I don't know that everyone's going to be interested in all the stuff they're doing, you know?
Yeah. I think about like the Avengers stuff. I never saw the Ant-Man movies. And so like the later Avengers stuff, definitely I wasn't in on all the jokes. I was definitely not up on all of it, but they did a good enough job to just tell me, here's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And here are the powers of Ant-Man here, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you know, like mostly Ant-Man serves as a visual gag. You know, when he's big, it's hilarious.
Sure.
And when he's small, he's hilarious. He might go up Thanos' ass and blow him up from the inside. Who knows? I think I'm Mando'd out. That's it for The Mandalorian. Send in feedback to mando@baldmove.com. The forums at baldmove.com are also there. We will be back next week for the finale. God mm-hmm. only knows what will happen. Where's Grogu going to be? Where's the Mando going to be? Are we going to keep Fett around for much longer? All interesting questions. We'll see what happens next week. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.